Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer and producer. The staff at KBOO has suggested that we develop a promo for our program, something catchy we'd regularly play to remind you what the Old Mole stands for. While we work on something short and punchy and somehow politically comprehensive, here's a collection of some familiar Old Mole voices and themes.
Wish I was a mole in the ground.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement. The Old Mole is a radio zine that comes at you every Monday morning, 9 to 10 a.m., with an hour of interviews, reviews, commentary, music, and perspective on how we can build a more democratic world.
Tear those mountains down.
Abortion rights in the 20th century was most severe following World War II, and I think is part of the dynamic of the repression of reproductive rights is the desire to control what is considered as the destabilizing effect of rampant female sexuality, if you want to put it that way.
Well, you could. Yeah. The idea of women being not only overtly sexual, but not simply as targets of interest from male people, but of their own selves. That was definitely not appreciated.
Tear those mountains down.
Where were you on this day, November 29th, 22 years ago? How about 5 years ago? For some of our listeners, for some of the Old Moles, at this hour, on this day, in 1999, we were gathering by buses on the way to Seattle to shut down the World Trade Organization, that effort to impose a corporation-dominated board over and beyond any national governmental institutions. That action, it's important to remember, was part of a democratic movement building worldwide.
Tear those mountains down.
The Civil War had been raging for more than a year, and black abolitionists, who had been increasingly pressuring Lincoln to end slavery, must have felt a sense of great anticipation and pride. The war was not going well for Lincoln. Britain was contemplating whether to intervene on the Confederacy's behalf, and Lincoln, unable to draw enough new white volunteers for the war, was forced to reconsider his opposition to allowing black Americans to fight for their own liberation.
Tear those mountains down.
Policing has to change. Alex Vitale, it's really a wonderful book. But first, what's wrong with modern policing?
Well, I think we have a pretty good sense of what the major problems are. Over the last 5 years with the rise of Black Lives Matter, we have a very good understanding about the excesses of police violence and the lack of accountability. I think what needs more attention is the broader problem of over-policing.
Tear those mountains down.
The monster who came up the river. This huge monster came up from the ocean. He would open his huge mouth and inhale anything that was in his path.
We've been recognizing this story by Esther Motonic, but as you say, there are many stories to tell, and they play in all cultures a vital role and have an important place and in inspiring people during a time that can seem bleak and hopeless, but also as we try to find a way forward through this climate catastrophe we're in.
Yep, we have to be coyote. We have to be creative. We have to think right.
Tear those mountains down.
The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. Tune in for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.
That was from our World Radio Day teaser back in February. And now to today's program. On this morning's episode of Another World is Possible, we bring you another Old Mole exclusive. We recently had Alex Diamond, a resident of Colombia, speaking on the significance of the election in that country. Today, Old Mole Luisa Martinez reports from Venezuela, interviewing Sofia Isabel Gonzalez Ortiz, a young woman activist, part of a group building a multi-tiered commune, serving her community in multiple ways. The interview is in English, so be prepared for it to be a bit slow. English is, of course, not Sofia's native language. But it's extraordinarily interesting to hear about the continuing effort to create alternative institutions, even while the U.S. government blocks needed resources and tries to undercut revolutionary aspirations. The interview begins with Sofia introducing herself and talking about her own path to political consciousness out of a right-wing family and joining La Minca commune. Minca, incidentally, is a Quechua word meaning collective work for the people. The background street noise you hear is in central Caracas.
My name is Sofia Isabel Gonzalez Ortiz. Mm-hmm. I am 24 years old. I was born and raised here in Caracas, Venezuela. Well, born in Caracas, raised in Miranda, okay. In El Atillo. And well, my context, like, why am I here and why I'm part of La Minca and the whole autogobierno and communes movement is because, like 2 years ago, I started realizing that the reality of the country and the story that has been told about the past 20 years, of course, from the opposition band, mm-hmm. has been a lie. So I started to gain my awareness of the reality and the context and how my role in the political and historical context is crucial to have it. And not only as a woman and a young woman, mm-hmm. here, but mostly like a revolutionary woman and how to contribute to that process and the liberation of my people. 2 years ago, exactly, I started reading more about like the class awareness that I had to have, well, the class consciousness. Other theories that were linked to communism. Mm-hmm. My family background comes from the right, mm-hmm. and my whole life was based in this heteropatriarchal, mm-hmm. and white supremacy basis. Mm-hmm. And I just stick with that because I really didn't know anything else. And I was a little bit afraid of get to know something else, mostly because of the way that my family thought about it more than what I thought about it. Long story short, I started studying more about communism and socialism, and I stood upon some theories from Simón Bolívar that I was surprised that were so linked to the liberation of the people, and that had similarities with these theories that I was reading about. Then I stood upon some speeches about Chávez, from Chávez. And I started reanalyzing his way of thinking and his way of speaking about the people and the way that he actually took place in the history of the country. And I realized that everything that I've been told was a lie about him. Well, that made me become a Chavista and actually wanted to take place politically, because I understood that this moment is crucial for my country, and I couldn't just stand there and, oh yes, I know this, mm-hmm. yay for me. I had to do something else. And I got to know La Minca through my partner, my actual partner. We met in a photography class that he gave. And I started coming here to this colectivo and fell in love with the project because I felt there was so much I could do. I work currently in social media. I am a content creator. So I started offering that for them like a professional, for actually getting to know the communities through the social media platforms that are so high in hype right now, and to have a different communications politics. Yes, and I started developing them with them and also with my partner, that he's a photographer just like me. And I started realizing that my role could be even more than that. I not only dedicate myself to politic, strategical, and content communications things, I also here have a role in the kitchen that works for a whole community. Like one of our politics as a collective in a comuna is to give everyone food. And since Chavez started the CLAP organizations that actually distributed these amazing boxes of supplies that brought foods that wouldn't go to waste too soon, it's been useful for us to organize that part here.
Okay, so so the CLAP boxes, tell me if I'm wrong, were developed as a result of the crises that have that have happened in the last couple, starting 2016, 2017.
Yes.
So they're just boxes of food that are available to everybody.
Exactly.
And so it was a way to respond to the emergency that was going on because of illegal sanctions imposed by the U.S. government.
Exactly.
Let's pause here before Luisa continues her interview with Sophia. It's always interesting to hear how someone transforms their understanding of the world and of the possibilities for social change. There are lessons in what enables that coming to consciousness. And then the issue becomes what to do with that new understanding. Luisa and Sophia go on to talk about the founding of La Minca, the commune, how it's a revolutionary project, and the different components that make up the commune. And that leads them to the struggle they face, both from the U.S. blockade and internal Venezuelan opposition.
So can you tell me, can you give some background about La Minca?
Yes, of course. And it's actually very, very attached to that part of our history here in the country. Well, La Minca has 10 years of establishment here in the town of La Pastora and Alta Gracia, because we are like a limit territory between those two towns. And it started as a cultural house where people could practice capoeira. Our founders are capoeiristas.
Mm-hmm. What is capoeira?
Yeah. Capoeira, it's a martial art that comes from Brazil. And it was only practiced by African-American people there. Then a Mestre Emerson, started to take capoeira all over Latin America. And he came here to Venezuela, and some of our comrades studied capoeira with him and brought it to our community as a way of not only having a martial art, because it's also a political statement to the whole supremacists, the white supremacist, and also a philosophy to live on. Mm-hmm. It has its basis and all these visions of culture. I cannot detail them because I'm not a capoeirista, but they're actually amazing. And I hope that you can interview one of our comrades that is one of them. But it was one of the main activities here. Mm-hmm. in that moment. This was actually a very old paper factory. And the first time that the Mingueros got here was with a vision of not only having a place to give classes of capoeira, but also to have a place where we could grow politically and that we could also keep the revolution alive. At that moment, of course, Chavez was alive and it was a different time. But since they took this place and started developing the cultural house, it's been crazy how much it has grown. We have also a stereography space mm-hmm. where we stamp our flags, we stamp our uniforms, also other people's uniforms and stuff, and also just t-shirts mm-hmm. that has to do with revolutionary stuff, because we believe in the opposite culture of this whole culture that's been imposed to us uh-huh. through capitalism and imperialism. Okay. So we believe that if we do our own clothes and our own designs, mm-hmm. we are actually making a political statement there. Also, we have a kitchen, just like I said. And in that time, in 2016, 2017, we started Quilombo. That is a very small farm in a place near our main cultural house. And there we farm. We don't only farm like the main ingredients of our diet, like plantain, bananas, papaya. We also have guanabana, yuca, some beans like quinchoncho, and we call them here toddy beans, but because they are chocolatey tasting uh-huh. and toddy is a very chocolatey beverage here uh-huh. in Venezuela. We also have small breeding animals, for example rabbits, chickens and ducks. They all are part of the kitchen supplies that we use in a daily basis to cook. And we made this politics then because there was no food coming to the country. And we had the sanctions, we had the blockings, the international blockings that actually went down to starve our people. And that's when we believed more than anything else that we needed to farm. And we needed to have urban farms and spaces for our people to actually have something to eat. We have a bakery that during that time, exactly 2 years before the whole blocking part of the international political states, we took the bakery in La Baralt that was called Mansion Bakery. And because they were starting a war with the bread, they took the flour in Quinta Crespo, they bought it, all the whole flour things that they had in Quinta Crespo that actually was very limited to everyone, and they had it mm-hmm. hide.
They were storing it,
they were hoarding it. And they sold it 10 times higher the price to everyone else in La Baralt.
Uh-huh. And this was during, again, this was a really rough time for Venezuela yes. and people were starving. So they yes. were hoarding, they were hoarding grain and then selling it.
They
at
were
10
hoarding.
Times.
This was like the first phases of the blocking before it was even announced. It was 2 years before they announced the international blockings. Uh-huh. They started to scarce some products that were main supplies for a lot of big and little industries of food to actually provide supplies to other supermarkets. These people had the audacity to not only have the hoarding of the flour, but also they didn't even sell a daily basis bread for everyone to eat. They sold only sweet bread and at a very high price. And also the food that they were serving to people was rotten.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they served rotten food to people. Our government took as a political to intervene those businesses that were speculating in prices, in supplies, that were hoarding, because that was a way, and a very well-known way from the right to sabotage. They actually did it in 1989, when the Caracazos happened.
What was just... What was the Caracazo? Yeah.
The Caracazo was a very well-known social implosion here. Some of them say that it was because Carlos Andrés Pérez that was a president in that moment. But it has a very important historical precedence before that specific date that got people to just explode that day. The poverty here was a lot, and the workers didn't even make half of the minimum salary that at that moment.
So just tell me if this is wrong. At the time, it was basically an austerity package that the president of Venezuela had sold Venezuela to, effectively, I think, the IMF.
Yes, yeah. To the IMF. And they just kept the workers very, very poor. They were so poor that they didn't even have for a package of milk. And because of that political move, they started sabotaging. Like, they just went to the store and took away the store. And they realized that the businessmen and women and the owners were keeping the whole food back out of the shelves to give the sensation of scarcity. And it was a lie.
Right.
There was food.
This false scarcity happened in 1989.
Yes, and that was a strategy that they wanted to pull in 2016 and 2017. But because it wasn't a successful move because of the Sunde.
What's the Sunde?
The Sunde, it was the institution that the government made to actually unmask this kind of strategies.
It's they like went an authority.
Yes, like an authority. They went business through business, specifically food businesses and pharmacies and other businesses that had to do with healthcare. And then they checked everything, like detailed everything. And at that moment, they found out the whole hoarding flour in Mansion Bakery. They found out the rotten food. They found everything that was going on. And they closed the bakery. So the government of Distrito Capital, our mayor in that moment was Carolina Sectari, gave the bakery to La Minca because she knew that we were here in the cultural house. We were making bread for people to give with the club box. So she said, who we can give this, that we will take, that they will take care of this. And they will actually have a communal politic to take this place. And she gave it to us. And we had a fight with them. We've had a lot of fights. And I think that the most sabotages that we suffered were among those days in 2017 with the guarimbas, because one of the sons of the owner was a guarimbero.
So the guarimbas were incidents of political violence.
Yes.
By the right that killed people in Venezuela.
Yes.
Yeah.
And La Minca, since we had the bakery, started to protect those territories. For instance, here in Altagracia, the cultural house was a very safe place for everyone to be. And it was like also a sort of commando place, because here the comrades reunited and had different stations to keep in touch with everyone else and to see what was going on around the territory and to take down the guarimbas that were being built in some streets. For instance, they built like these sort of forts with garbage and old tires and stuff, and even wires to cut heads. Mm-hmm. It was very violent. So La Minca started taking those things down.
I see.
Yes. It was a very strategic point at that moment, and the bakery never stopped working. Was always opened for everyone in the community to have something to eat, because it's not only the poor people that they want to target, it's also the power, because there's powerful people mm-hmm. that lost their places and they want them back. So they are going to go to the last instance to sabotage.
Mm-hmm. And by they, you mean the opposition?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, I mean the opposition. And to regain the power, the whole power, to have the government back. And that also means there's infiltration of the right in our front. And we are constantly fighting with it. Even the president is constantly fighting with it. I believe that we are more the revolutionary people that are involved than the ones that are sabotaging. And that's why the revolution here keeps on going. But they still manage to slow down the process and to actually tear down some bridges that we built with Chavez to somehow close doors. But the thing is that they don't realize that we've been building bridges and windows and even little doors since day one, because that's the way that we have gained the whole power until now.
I'd like to pause here again. We've learned something important, that the process of social transformation in Venezuela isn't simply top-down, that there continues to be space for creating alternative institutions, and that these are contested. They're not built fresh from a revolutionary blueprint, but as adaptations in the face of continuing class opposition. What then does this mean for the role of women? How do you evaluate what Sophia is going to tell us? And what's the takeaway for us here in the U.S.? Luisa?
Okay, so when we talk about La Minca, we mean mm-hmm. the cultural house.
Yes.
The bakery.
Yes.
And basically the mini farm that you have here.
Yes.
Okay. Would you say that it's mostly women who arrange these?
Yes. And actually, it's a pretty common thing to see all over the country. Uh-huh. Mostly women are the ones in charge of the clap part. And I think that it has to do with patriarchy thought of the women being just in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. That they don't have a political role mm-hmm. more than the kitchen. But the curious part is that it is actually a political act to be part of that space. So somehow it's a resignification of the space of the kitchen and the role of the women. And it's not only women that are involved, but mostly they are in charge. For instance, here in La Minca, we have two chefs that are men, Bubi and the poet. Mostly I cook, but because I actually love it. But when I don't cook, they do it. Mm-hmm. And it's not an issue. But when it comes to representation in the spaces like the House of Feeding, that's like our first instance, institutionally talking, of organization from the kitchens in the territory.
Okay, before La Minca?
Yeah. Okay. Because we have our kitchen and we serve a certain amount of people in the territory. And there are other kitchens that belong to other movements or projects.
Okay.
That feed another amount of people. And we all belong to one house, a feeding house, that is in charge of distributing the supplies, that is in charge of taking like lists of the people that we benefit, and those datas go to a government data so they can actually see how the plans and all the goals, yes, that have been planned for a certain amount of period have been going on or have been taken care of. And the feeding house is also in charge of communicating those plans and the goals and the whole way of organizing the territory in the matter of clap and kitchen things. And in those places, the ones that have more influence are women. And it seems like, oh, it's just another patriarchy thing, but it's still something that I am actually studying, because it actually adds a very powerful and empowering statement that food and cooking are very, very, very important to keep a revolution going. We are poor people. We're poor people having this amazing project.
What would you tell people in the United States about Venezuela that's against the narrative that they hear from the US government?
What can I say to the people of the United States that they don't know about the country? There are so many things. There are so many details that are not said. But I think that the main one is that most information that media gives about my country, they are exaggerating it and even emphasizing problems that aren't there. And I can assure you firsthand that when they interview some political subjects in the front, they interview the same political subjects that consume their content and not other visions.
The people who are interviewed in the United States, the people who you commonly hear about representing Venezuela, are maybe from the right or from the same political group.
Exactly. Yes, from the same political group. And coming from that political group, because I grew up there, it's weird to listen, for example, in a common family meeting, all the things that they say about the country that they live in,
mm-hmm.
and to go out and actually see other realities and get to know other people. For instance, there was this movement of satanization of the whole Misión Vivienda movement. For a while, it was said that in the east part of the city, here in Caracas, the government would take houses of middle class people
mm-hmm.
between a lot of comillas.
Yeah, so the Misión, just to give some background, the Misión Vivienda housing project is really just a way to provide free housing to people,
yes.
who otherwise would never be able to afford a house,
yes.
in Venezuela.
Exactly. And there was a satanization of that movement that the government did. And a lot of houses of that particular movement and that mission went down to corruption because the people didn't believe in it. And it was a whole media satanization through the right,
uh-huh.
to talk a lot of things that weren't actually happening, but started to happen because of the satanization that it had.
Okay, so, right, they were demonized.
Yes,
demonized. Yeah, so then there have been, you're saying, campaigns by the right wing to demonize the housing project, saying that the government is taking away people's
yes.
houses and stuff like that. And it has created blocks, right?
Yes.
But it's still been a successful...
Exactly.
It's still been a successful soldier project, despite what the right has done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of the houses that they built I have the knowledge of people that actually got it and sold them, but sold them beyond the prices that the government gave them, mm-hmm. because they actually are entitled to sell their house. Mm-hmm. But they were sold prices incredibly high, and they were allowed to do this because they were people of power mm-hmm. that were infiltrated in that kind of sectors, the revolutionary fight. And this was actually something that happened because all the demonization of that the media did. Uh-huh. And I even to this day listen to my mother say that the home misión vivienda doesn't work because of that. And I have a lot of friends that live in Misión Vivienda, and if it wasn't because of that mission that Chavez did, they wouldn't have a roof over their head, and they wouldn't have a dignified home right now.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, just from the basics in terms of what people hear in the United States. First and foremost, Venezuela is a dictatorship.
Yeah.
That, you know, they might hear that, you know, Juan Guaido, that it's contested, right? That it's not clear who's president of Venezuela. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would actually respond that if this was a dictatorship, I would have been killed by now. And it's not because I am part of or I am actually agreeing with the project of the government and I am part of the government project. Because something that the communist does is to take the power and give it to the people. Dictatorships don't want that. Dictators look for the whole power, and that's it. And they kill anything and anyone getting in the way of that. If it was a dictatorship, I think that comunas wouldn't be a thing in the country. And they are actually a thing. And they're giving a lot of safe spaces to people to start and go ahead with the movement of auto-government and independency. And that speech that Juan Guaido gives is always from the greediness of power the Venezuelan right has. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the things that I was telling you in the beginning of this interview, that group of people that lost the power. And I really think that they are not going back because it doesn't depend on the government. It depends on the people. And if it wasn't because of the people, they wouldn't be the communal politics. There wouldn't be a lot of the spaces that we have right now in the revolution and that we keep and sustain every single day, because I'm not the only one involved in this amazing project. So yeah, there's no dictatorship. Don't listen to that hypocrites, because the ones that actually made a dictatorship out of something that was supposed to be a democracy were them when they were in the power.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for the invitation, Luisa.
Of course.
Again, that was Luisa Martinez interviewing Sofia Sabel Gonzalez Ortiz, offering a perspective on Venezuela that's not only not widely available in the U.S., but is actively suppressed. The continuing efforts at a grassroots level to build a better society, even in the face of U.S.-imposed hardships. That Quechua word, minca, meaning collective work for the people, is worth remembering. Remember, too, that this is community-powered, democratically run KBOO in Portland. And now, writer and photographer Matt Witt reviews The Financial Lives of the Poets, a novel by Spokane author Jess Walter. I've talked on The Old Mole about Walter's historical novel, The Cold Millions, set during the free speech fights by the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, more than a century ago. The financial lives of the poets is set in our own times. As corporate interests make jobs in America more precarious, a lot of households that thought of themselves as middle class are now living paycheck to paycheck, struggling with the cost of housing, healthcare, and education. This novel follows one such couple whose lives are spinning out of control. Matt?
Jess Walter, the novelist from Spokane, has a way of capturing the times we live in and how they make everyday people feel. He has a gift for spinning tall tales that hit close to home, and for mixing humor, absurdity, and tragedy in equal parts, much like real life. He did it in his haunting novel, The Zero, about a New York cop who lost his bearings after 9/11, just as the larger society did. In his more recent book called The Cold Millions, young workers who just wanted a better world found themselves up against politicians and police controlled by corporate millionaires. And in his novel called The Financial Lives of the Poets, he follows a middle-aged couple, Matthew and Lisa, whose dreams and dilemmas will be recognized by many readers dealing with today's world. Matthew was a business writer for the local newspaper, but as newspapers were being bought up by larger companies who then slashed the number of reporters, he decided to launch his own internet startup, a website where you could find investment advice in the form of poetry. Poetfolio, he called it. At first, it attracted a small grant from a wealthy heiress who loved poetry. But like most startups, it didn't take off, and it soon became a drain on the family's finances instead of a magical path to riches. Meanwhile, Matthew's wife, Lisa, had another idea for supplementing the family income and began buying collectibles online that she thought she could resell on eBay at a big profit. Soon their garage was full of figurines and toys she bought, only to find there was no resale market for them. On top of their economic woes, Matthew and Lisa are of the sandwich generation, taking care of Matthew's father, who lives with them and repeats the same conversations over and over, and their two young sons, who have their own daily dramas at school. Their lives turn from insecurity to crisis when the financial institution that holds the mortgage on their house informs Matthew that if they continue to default on their debts, they will soon face foreclosure. Matthew can't bear to share this news with his wife, especially since she seems to be responding to the stress they're under by using social media to start an affair with her high school sweetheart, a man with a steady job at the local lumberyard. From here, the story gets simultaneously more outlandish and more real as Matthew pursues another harebrained scheme to save his house and his marriage, getting involved with hapless young men trying to survive through small-time drug deals, a couple of cops desperate to make some arrests to justify next year's budget, and another would-be entrepreneur with a great startup idea. The engaging stories Jess Walter tells in his novels typically focus on men as the main characters, and he has a gift for getting inside their heads and capturing each one's unique way of talking. But his books also shed light on the trajectory of our society. In the case of The Financial Lives of the Poets, that includes the way many middle-class households are now living paycheck to paycheck and struggling to stay ahead of the debt collectors, and the way economic insecurity leaves many men struggling with their self-image as a man, a parent, and a husband, and the way that corporate interests and their political allies feed us the false hope that everyone has a chance to become a millionaire in the tech economy. Will Matthew and Lisa survive? Read The Financial Lives of the Poets to find out.
Thank you, Matt Witt, reviewing a novel by Jess Walter. Time now for some Old Mole insights into last week's elections. The Left and the Laws, John Hocken and Mike Snedeker, particularly followed how climate politics fared. Then they cross national borders to explore new legal strategies that climate activists in the global south have been developing, including through the COP27 meetings in Egypt last week. Jan and Mike?
At the COP27 meetings in Egypt last week, Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, opened the conference with a stark warning and call to action. "We are in the fight of our lives and we are losing," he said. "We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot on the accelerator." Well, looking at the midterm elections here in the US, the largest contributor historically to global warming, results so far suggest that we have pulled back a bit from that accelerator. Many of the election deniers and climate deniers did not win their elections, including Christine Drazen, who ran for governor and lost to Tina Kotek. So Mike, let's look at a few of the highlights and the lowlights of the midterms and then turn to COP27 meetings in Egypt that were sidelined by the drama of the midterms. What about the governor's race? Should we start there?
Well, let's do, because it's a stark example of how and why these days voting for Democrats is a must. And I know full well that the Democrats are every bit as bad as the Republicans on issues of war and peace.
Well, you know, though, how the old saying goes, that the Democratic Party is a graveyard of progressive movements.
I know that. And when it comes to banks, for example, who brought the whole world to a precipice in 2008, the Democrats are every bit as bad as the Republicans. But the fossil fuel industry, the third blob of power after the military-industrial complex and the banks or the oil companies, and here there's been a really interesting and important split. The Democrats, because of since maybe beginning with Al Gore, but certainly most recently, are finding sources of revenue to support their political campaigns from alternate energy sources. And for various reasons, they are becoming a real alternative. And it's a big world out there, and they make a big difference, not only in those social issues like abortion that the big blobs of power don't really care about, but also they're enabling us to seriously take on the issue of climate change. And I think the difference and the reasons why are clearly illustrated by Oregon's governmental race.
Yeah, Drazen, an anti-abortion conservative, of course, was also, she promised to gut regulation of fossil fuel industries in the region and roll back climate initiatives, including the cap and trade program that Kate Brown passed through executive action in 2020. And Tina Kotek has been a supporter of it, as have the Democrats. I think that illustrates also some of where the rubber meets the road there, because progressive groups such as the Sunrise Movement have opposed cap and trade legislation and have argued that it really commodifies pollution, brings it within a market system. There are many ways these companies can work around the effects of it in ways that companies lower down in the energy system have fewer protections. So I think there are these fights ahead.
Well, Jan, Kate Brown did much better than the cap and trade. Her executive order in 2020, but she put absolute limits on greenhouse gas emissions. Her directives had to do with limiting the overall release of carbon dioxide into the air, which is far more effective than any cap and trade.
I agree that the Democrats have embraced climate justice and doing something within the time frame set by scientists. And the Democrats have to respond to a growing movement of young people who have made this a top priority. We've also followed civil suits against Big Oil, led by Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and he was reelected by Minnesota voters, narrowly defeating Jim Scholz, whose campaign was funded by a subsidiary of the Koch brothers. What do you make of that victory?
Well, that was very good. He was out there. He was famous as an attorney general for suing the oil companies. And as we've said before, the oil companies are so powerful. They're making so much money now, paradoxically, because of the war in the Ukraine, the spike upward in oil prices. But Keith Ellison has held their feet to the fire as much as one can. And it's very heartening that he was able to survive, because we need people like him. He can and has done a variety of effective moves to limit the use of fossil fuels in Minnesota. All over the country, there have been people who were identified with this issue who were successful in the midterm election.
There were some other interesting state ballots that give cause for encouragement. Of course, abortion rights were codified in many states. Marijuana was legalized. There's also this ballot measure around legal slavery, abolishing it in Alabama, Tennessee, and Vermont, as well as Oregon. It did not pass in Louisiana. What's your take on that? It was very close in Oregon.
Well,
but the amendment did pass.
It was never really the subject of much discussion. It was just kind of a floater in there. It's a effort to undo a proviso in the 13th Amendment, which allows slavery to continue effectively for prisoners. And when we've had this explosion of incarceration over the past three decades, there have been more and more people have been made aware of it because they've been subjected to work regimes within prison. I think it's a really important and really valuable passage. I don't draw a lot of significance because it was not politically an issue. I mean, if you look around at the coverage of the election, so many other issues absorbed all the available space. So I think I'm very happy that it passed. I think the fact that it was relatively close is not that important.
So that might be also something to return to around prison politics down the road.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about the Conference of the Parties 27. Such an odd term for a meeting that where so much is at stake. And Guterres also opened the conference by saying we can sign a climate solidarity pact or a collective suicide pact, in calling the attendees to action. And, you know, it may be better to frame the situation as a holdup where many nations and community are very much at hostage to the industries that are killing them. What's your take on some of the news coming out from COP27, including this campaign that's been around a while, but getting more leverage and calls for loss and damages to be paid by wealthy, high-polluting countries?
Well, that's the issue. That's the one big issue that is highlighted by COP27. And you can say that it is gradually being absorbed by fossil fuel companies who have some 680 lobbyists present there to try to sell natural gas as a transitional fuel rather than as a fossil fuel, and to generally lobby and to limit damages and to avoid damages to their pocketbooks. But it is an opportunity for those parts of the world that are being devastated by climate change to speak up and ask for some forms of reparations.
The history of these conference of parties have been ones of hopes and bitter disappointments that follow, as commitments made are often not fulfilled or fulfilled at a fraction of the commitments made. It's like New Year's resolutions.
That's true. The developed societies, which now include China, acknowledge in the abstract, yes, there's the links between their own economic success and the floods in Pakistan and the damage done to island nations and problems in Africa that are the direct result of that success. And they say, we need to do something. But in terms of what, I mean, they resist the notion of liability because it makes it seem like a legal right. They definitely resist the term reparations. So the term now, the operative phrase is loss and damages. So everybody's a willing, you know, so that's a
recognized category under the law.
Yes. So there are efforts. Yes. Yeah. We recognize there are loss and that there are damages and there's some connection, but it's very hard to specifically link one oil refinery to the rise of one particular river in Pakistan.
And although so, apparently there's a growing technology that can pinpoint pretty accurately sources of emissions.
We'll never, you know, we don't know a lot about cause and effect in general, and we certainly are never going to be able to quantify precisely who's burning does what to who, but they can approximate much better than they could have even a decade ago. And they are making pitches in this group called the Vulnerable 20, which now includes about 50 to 60 nations in Africa and mostly in the Southern Hemisphere, are making a concerted effort to get specific and bring about the kind of detailed criticisms that will make it harder and harder for countries who have generally acknowledged obligation to squirm away from making specific reparations.
Okay, well, Mike, we'll continue to follow these developments through the lens of climate justice and organizing around climate justice. And it, as I say, it could have been worse after the midterm elections.
That's true.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
And that's our program for this autumnal Monday morning. This has been Norm Diamond, with thanks to Old Mole's Luisa Martinez, Matt Witt, Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, Patricia Kohlberg, and our Venezuelan guest, Sofia Sabel Gonzalez Ortiz. Thanks to Old Mole Denise Morris for our World Radio Day teaser, and to the stalwart KBOO staff. Tune in again next Monday morning. Meanwhile, stay safe and stay active.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If there's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.